Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. NHBR's station-wide series, The First Decade, is looking at how income disparities in the lives of children can affect their choices later in life. Today, we're looking at the way kids play, which research shows is becoming increasingly stratified. A 2012 report from the American Academy of Pediatrics found that schools in low-income areas are more likely to cut recess, and that the costs of sports equipment, fees, and travel are prohibitive to many low-income families. Behavioral research reveals that low-income children are less likely to participate in sports and display lower levels of outdoor play. But what about indoor play? Greg Toppo is USA Today's National Education and Demographics reporter. In a new book, he argues that electronic games have been unfairly maligned for making children fat, violent, and lazy, and that today's video games can be one way of leveling the playing field. Greg, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So technology, games in general, often thought to be the root of brain rot for children or the downfall of education. Your book argues that games actually make kids smarter. Broadly, how?
Well, you know, at the very basis of this is this idea that games give kids access to material in a way that really sparks their imagination and that allows them to try out the material, fail, come back with a better plan, and really sort of learn at their own pace and learn more deeply. And that's something that, you know, school has been trying to do for centuries and has always struggled to do. And I think one of the things that excited me about this topic was that games presented a way to do that we hadn't seen before.
Well, you make the case that this is not just about play and access to learning, but forging friendships, which seems counterintuitive when I think of, you know, the solitary nature of playing games.
Sure. I mean, from the very beginning, the world of video games really was about playing with other people. When you think about, you know, the first important video game, which was something like Pong, I mean, you played against another person. Obviously, a lot of games since then have been these solitary games where you're playing against a computer. But, you know, if you were to kind of drop into your typical teenager's after-school game-playing sessions, more often than not, they would be playing against their friends or with their friends, you know, either in the same room or, you know, at a distance, you know, through the internet. I think as adults, we don't really understand the role that socializing has begun playing in game playing. And it's really, really fascinating to me and something I think we just sort of miss.
Well, access is something that we're talking about with our series, and you're talking about access to material and learning.
Sure.
But I'm thinking of in these multiple player games, you know, where you can be playing with people at any given time from people all over the world. No one knows what you look like, what you're wearing, what kind of house you live in. Can games also be a kind of equalizer?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the most interesting interviews I did was actually a series of interviews with a teacher who found exactly that sort of the social constructs sort of melted when she started using games in the classroom, because kids started judging each other not on, you know, the cut of their clothes or how expensive their shoes were or, you know, where they lived, but how well they played the game and how helpful they were and how smart they were. Really fascinating. I mean, it happened very quickly. I think that's a phenomenon that a lot of players have kind of found a lot of comfort in. It's a real, in a way, kind of a real meritocracy. Mm. That's powerful for a young person.
Well, your book is, of course, about games for learning, but also healing was a big eye-opener for me. You spoke with a game designer. Now, this is someone who was diagnosed with ADD at a young age, spent most of his life on Ritalin and Adderall, and now envisions games as a kind of alternative to prescription drugs. What's his story?
This is one of my favorite people in the book. I'm a young game designer named Lat Ware, who grew up in North Carolina, and as you said, you know, was diagnosed at a very young age with ADD, began taking medication every morning, didn't like the way it made him feel, and thought, you know, I really need to do something about this. He was also, I think, kind of really, in a kind of a wonderful way, just obsessed with Star Wars from a very young age, from 6 years old, and decided that he wanted to be a Jedi Knight because he loved the way they moved objects with their minds.
Well, who wouldn't?
Yeah, exactly. but unlike most of us, he did something about it, and he actually he went to school, you know, after high school, went to college to learn how to design video games, and then came across this EEG headset that did exactly that, that used your brainwaves to move objects on screen. And it took a couple of years to develop this game that amusingly is called Throw Trucks with Your Mind. And I played it, and it actually, that is what you do. It is exactly as advertised. It's a game that requires the player to be calm and focused, and you see calm and focused meters dead center in the middle of the screen. And the more calm and the more focused you are, the more control you have over what happens in the game. And really remarkable. You actually play the game essentially hands-free.
And this is actually being tested now by the FDA, hoping to market it as a substitute for drugs like Ritalin and Adderall.
Yeah, that's right. I talk in the chapter about how there's this kind of quiet foot race to create the first prescription-strength video game. And that's not a metaphor. You know, that's real. They're trying to get approval for a game that a doctor can prescribe. And I think it's still a few years off, but I think it's coming.
He's not alone. The psychiatrist Bruce Wexler, someone else you interview, he's at Yale. He also advocates using video games as a kind of therapy. So what is he doing? And tell us how that's being tested.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so Bruce, you know, as you say, you know, he's this Yale psychiatrist who actually started investigating this field 20 years ago. You know, he became one of the first people to use something called CCRT, computerized cognitive remediation, to help people suffering from schizophrenia. And one of the things that he found was that if you kind of break the disease down into component parts and strengthen certain functions like memory and attention, you can really have a great impact on this. And you can, you know, people can hold down jobs and are more sort of healthy, basically. And he essentially took that knowledge and started developing games for things like ADHD. And he actually, interestingly enough, he is one of the people who has decided that, you know, sitting and playing a game is not enough. He has also incorporated exercise into the regimen. And, you know, I mean, that's something a lot of ADHD therapists have recommended for a long time, that exercise is really, really helpful.
Are video games rotting your kids' brains? Well, Greg Topo is with us. He's USA Today's National Education and Demographics reporter and author of a book that says digital play can actually make kids a lot smarter. There are a number of examples in the book about how gaming is being used to change kids' cognitive functions. Well, we're wondering if that works for kids across the economic and social spectrum. Bruce Wexler has also been working on therapies that remediates key deficits in poor kids' lives. What specifically has he done in that area?
You know, this is just kind of more, I think, along the same lines. You know, what he found was that, you know, like a lot of people, that low-income kids, they're not as cognitively stimulated in their daily lives as middle-class kids. You know, so he's actually focused very much on things like executive function. And what he's found is that it's not really a metaphor. If you can help exercise that, kids can be more successful. Mm-hmm. He's got a very interesting term. He calls it the school lunch program for the brain. And I think that's kind of an interesting way to think about it.
We're talking about specifically so-called educational games or games for change. How about your everyday games like Assassin's Creed or Madden NFL? Do those actually do anything cognitively or socially for kids?
When you step back and think about them, they do a lot cognitively. When you're playing these games, it's really cognitively demanding just to get through the game. You know, there's this idea of hard fun that is kind of a bedrock principle in the game design world. As people from the outside looking in, you know, we tend to think that gamers think games are fun because they're easy, right? You know, it's kind of a way to kick back and just not think too hard.
Mm-hmm.
And what a gamer would say is, no, games are fun because they're hard, they're challenging, they're requiring something of me that I may not be able to do, and oftentimes I can't do, so I have to come back again and again and again, you know, the term I use is, you know, you have to come back with a better plan next time. But one of the things that games have always done really well is let the player fail and then come back right away.
Mm-hmm.
It's essentially sort of invisible, you know, that there's no delay between you failing and you starting right upright again, you know.
Getting back on the horse,
mm-hmm. Yeah, with no judgment and no, you know, no fuss at all.
Well, in the book, you say that there's a Stanford scholar that found that a lot of teachers are skeptical of technology or resistant to changing things. So we see these impressive results, but what about schools that are reluctant to incorporate video games in the classroom or can't afford to?
I think the reluctance is melting a little bit because so many people in real life have experiences with these games. You know, I mean, I don't know about you personally, but I imagine you have a smartphone and maybe someone in your family has a tablet. You know, people are having experiences with games at a very kind of basic, quiet level, and they're starting to see the power of these tools. So I think that's sort of melting some of people's resistance. And your question about, you know, historically why this hasn't worked is because I think, in general, I think the tools haven't been sophisticated enough. They've been kind of standardized in a way. Here we're finding, I think, that these tools can really, really be customized to what students need to do. And, you know, the second part of your question about the cost, I mean, one of the most interesting things to me is that a lot of these tools, a lot of some of the really sophisticated tools, they're consciously being distributed for free. So I think the digital divide, I mean, in a way, I mean, if this were like this great big Cadillac expensive tool, I wouldn't be as excited because, sure, you know, if you spend enough money, you can do almost anything. I think the real potential in this is to bring things to schools at a very low cost. If we can't do that, I think there's a way in which we've kind of failed.
Well, Greg Topo, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Greg Topo is USA Today's National Education and Demographics Reporter. He's also a former teacher and author of The Game Believes in You, How Digital Gameplay Can Make Our Kids Smarter. And you can see all the stories from our special series, The First Decade, at nhpr.org. There's also a terrific infographic on how income affects kids' participation in enrichment activities. It's again on our series page for The First Decade at nhpr.org.